Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivered the I Have a Dream speech in August 1963, the I Have a Dream section wasn't part of the prepared text. There's a story behind that, and most everything about the speech, the March on Washington that attracted some 250,000 people to Washington, and the movement behind both. Joining us today is Clarence Jones, who served as an advisor to Dr. King. Professor Jones was King's personal lawyer and one of his speechwriters, and he helped draft the I Have a Dream speech and stood just a few yards from King as he delivered the address that day. Dr. Jones's latest book, Behind the Dream, Inside the Speech That Transformed a Nation, was published in January. He is a scholar in residence and visiting professor at the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. He will be speaking at the Gene B. McCoy Community Center for the Arts in New Albany this week. Please visit our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. Welcome to the show, Professor Jones.
Welcome. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you. Yes, I will be at the, the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany on Wednesday.
Right. Okay, on Wednesday. And anyone, there are apparently some still some tickets available, so you can go to WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that and a link and so forth. Professor Jones, I want you to first tell us how you and Martin Luther King Jr. met and how he got you involved in the movement in the first place. It wasn't your first choice of employment, apparently.
Well, as I've said this story repetitively, and I'll try to break it down for you, is that in February 1960, Martin Luther King Jr. was indicted by the state of Alabama for tax evasion and perjury. At that time, I was a 29-year-old lawyer who was just 6 months out of law school, having been in the United States military during the end of the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
Although I was stationed in the United States, I was not in combat in Korea, but I was a military veteran. And he was, and his chief defense counsel was a man by the name of Judge Hubert Delaney. And Judge Delaney, who was head of the defense team, headed with three other lawyers, felt that they needed a law clerk to go and help them prepare the defense. And so he asked me to do just that. I was at that time, and just recently moved to California, Southern California, and for me to help, I had to go to Montgomery, Alabama, so I declined, and that began the, that telephone call I had was on a Thursday evening, and on the following day, following Friday morning, I got a call in which the judge had said he didn't know it at the time of our conversation on Thursday evening, but that Dr. King was on his way to California, where I live, because he had a previous speaking engagement. And he had said to Dr. King, well, since you're going out there to keep the speaking engagement, which is on Saturday, why don't you try to stop by and see this young lawyer I told you about? So that's the next thing I knew. Dr. King and Reverend Bernard Lee are at my door. And Friday evening, they're sitting in my living room. And that was how I met Martin King. He had, sat and said that Judge Delaney had told him about me, and the theme of his discussion that evening was very direct.
Which you attended later.
I'm sorry?
You attended the speech after he visited you, right?
Oh, yeah, well, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he spoke at a church you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he visited me to come and talked about the need for young Negro lawyers and professionals to help the movement, and that was on a Friday evening, and then on Sunday morning, I found myself sitting in a church where he had was the guest preacher,
mm-hmm.
and he had referred to not looking at me, but he was talking about again in his sermon to the guests to the church in Baldwin Hills, Los Angeles. The theme of his sermon was the role and responsibility and need of Negro professionals to aid the civil rights movement, never looking at me. He gave a very eloquent and passionate appeal for those people who were professionals, lawyers, doctors, Negroes, who to come and support and help the movement. And then during the course of the his address, never looking at me, he said, for example, there's a young man in this church today, didn't mention my name, just said who his friends in New York told him it was very talented and his brain had been touched by the Lord, so to speak. And he went on and on, described this me and this, then not me, but this person whom I never thought was me, the way he described it. And then as he continued, he said, but you know, I had a chance to visit with this young lawyer just the other evening in his home. And then I knew he was talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to shrink in my seat as he then, in effect, I had shared some things with him about my life. My parents were domestic workers. In effect, Dr. King said, I had forgotten from whence I came. My parents had been domestic workers, and he had quoted a poem by Langston Hughes. Only he did poetic license, and he reconfigured the words of the poem to put my mother as a character in the poem. The poem is about a Negro domestic worker scrubbing the floors. And she pauses at a landing and says, I'm doing this for you, son. Life ain't been no crystal stair. That's the name of the poem, by the way. Life mm-hmm. ain't no crystal stair. But I'm doing this for you. So when he quoted this poem using my mother as a character in it, tears began to roll down my face because I was moved, because I could remember how I was the beneficiary, like so many of those other professionals in the church, of parents who sacrificed everything to make it possible for me to have education. Anyway, so I was. When he talked about me, he never looked at me and so forth. So when the sermon was over, I went over to him and he looked at me as I walked toward him like a Cheshire cat had swallowed a mouse. And he had this smile. He says, "You know, I never mentioned your name, Mr. Jones. I never mentioned your name." And as I got to him, I just put my hand in his hand and I said, Dr. King, when do you want me to go to Montgomery, Alabama? I was so moved by his impassioned plea that turned me around.
My guest is Clarence Jones with Stuart Connolly. He has written a new book. It's called Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. And that speech would be the I Have a Dream speech. If you have a question or comment for Professor Jones, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you go to our new website at wosu.org/allsides, you can comment right there now. So check that out.
And Ms. Fisher.
Yes, sir.
Is that I think if I could have a minute, I'd like to just, for your listeners, I'd like to get, this happened many years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just the speech, but it's also the event. So if I could just take maybe 2 or 3 minutes, I don't know how much time I have.
You have a whole hour. You have 45 minutes.
Oh, great. So let me just read something, because I want to paint a word picture
okay.
for listeners to appreciate this. This is from the introduction of what I write. I say 250,000 people, human beings who generally had spent their lives treated as something less, stood shoulder to shoulder across that vast lawn, their hearts beating as one, hope on the line, when hope was an increasingly scarce resource. There is no dearth of prose describing the mass of humanity that made its way to the feet of the great emancipator, meaning the Lincoln Memorial that day. No metaphor that has slipped through the cracks waiting to be discovered, dusted off, and injected into the discourse a half a century on. Has been compared to a tsunami, a shockwave, a wall, a living monument, a human mosaic, an outright miracle. It was all of those things. And if you saw it with your own eyes, it wasn't hard to write about. With that many people in one place crying out for something so elemental, you don't have to be Robert Frost to offer some profound eloquence. Still, I can say to those who know the event only as a steely black and white television image, it's a shame that the colors of that day, the blue sky, the vibrant green light, the golden sun everywhere, are not part of our national memory. there is something heart-wrenching about the widely shown images and film clips of the event that belies the joy of the day. But it could be worse. We could have been marching in an era before cameras and recording devices. Then the specifics of the event would eventually fade out of living memory, and the world would be left only with the mythology and the texts. We are truly fortunate to have a record. Yet what the television cameras and radio microphones captured that August day is but a sliver of the vibrancy of the event. And then I go on, when a film adaptation of a beloved novel premieres, the people who say, oh, but you've got to read the book, are inevitably right. The density of the written word makes that flat motion picture a pale artifact in comparison. In similar fashion, although watching the black and white news footage of Dr. King's historic call to action is stirring to almost everyone who sees it, learning about the work that went into the march and the speech, the discussions and debates behind closed doors, offers a unique context that magnifies the resonance of hearing those famous words, I have a dream, and that phenomenal, inimitable cadence.
The day was the consequence of masterful planning for many months, many weeks at least. You had offices in different cities in the country planning this.
Yes, the March on Watching, the organization headed by the legendary labor and civil rights leader, A. Philip Randolph, as the book talks, and those of you who maybe know something about it, the March on Washington really was the umbrella organization for several civil rights organizations and labor unions and the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., the Catholic Archdiocese. Mm-hmm. It was an umbrella organization chaired by A. Philip Randolph. The chief of staff was Bayard Rustin. But you had organizations like the National Council of Negro Women, headed by Dorothy Height, the National Urban League, the NAACP, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, then chaired by now Congressman John Lewis. You had the Congress of Racial Equality. You had the United Automobile Workers. You had the Catholic Archdiocese of Washington. And you had a whole consortium, and the NAACP, of course. Mm-hmm. You had a whole consortium of civil rights organizations. That's what the March on Washington was. It consisted of an umbrella organization chaired by A. Philip Randolph.
Who had the dream of this way back in the 30s, actually.
Yes, he did. In the first Roosevelt administration, when he was seeking to get Roosevelt to pass the Fair Employment Practices Act for those following the Second World War, following the Second World War, as well as some of the unemployment that had occurred during the Roosevelt's first administration. Mm-hmm. So he had this dream all his life, and his imprint was on the march because on the organization because he had this view of finally assembling from all walks of life, people from all over the country to come and make a statement. And, of course, he did that because, this was August 1963, followed by the Martin King's successful campaign in April and May of 1963 in desegregating public accommodations in Birmingham, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so it was an extraordinary time.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Clarence Jones. We're talking about his new book. It's called Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Professor Jones worked very closely with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. For years before the 1963 March on Washington and after. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Good morning from 89.7 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point begins, and it's tax time. On Point looks at who pays, who does not, and the way ahead on taxes. That discussion begins at 1 this afternoon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
And it's 57 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a slight chance of rain today, otherwise cloudy skies and a high of 67. A chance of rain tonight with a thunderstorm also possible, a low of 49 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are likely for Tuesday and a high of 67 degrees, and more rain Tuesday night with a low of 60. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Clarence Jones. He serves as an advisor to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He was Dr. King's personal lawyer and one of his speechwriters. He helped draft the I Have a Dream speech and stood just yards from King as he delivered the address that day in 1963. If you have a question or comment for Professor Jones, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you attended the speech that day, if you remember it from watching on television or listening on the radio, we'd love to have you call and tell us what your impressions were of it then and now. 614-292-8513. You mentioned, Professor Jones, that back in the 30s, when A. Philip Randolph first came up with the idea of the march, was during the first Roosevelt administration, and the president managed to avert the march one way or another. And by the time it came around to 1963, similar efforts, or at least the administration of John F. Kennedy, was no less concerned about such a march on Washington.
Yes, yes. Initially, the march was planned to be around to have the demonstration at Capitol Hill, and the president and the attorney general felt that since there was a bill pending in Congress, he felt that the Congress would regard the march as being a gun to their head as they were deliberating a civil rights bill. So we were persuaded to move the march from the Capitol, geographically, from the Capitol to the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. And as I go on in the book, I say, for those of us who put the march together, several aspects of that day struck a chord and went on to have profound effect on us. First was the most obvious, the size of the crowd. It was truly staggering. Mm-hmm. Estimates vary widely depending on the attendee who was keeping count. But those of us who were involved in the planning of the march put the number at a minimum of 250,000. They showed up to connect with the movement, to draw strength from the speakers and from each other. This was perhaps not so surprising, since the underpinning of the civil rights movement had always been our sense of communal strength. It is in part why the black church was the focal point for the movement. It allowed individuals to see that they were not alone in their suffering, their loss of dignity, their humiliation. But congregations were measured in the hundreds of families, not hundreds of thousands. The march was a especially important milestone for African Americans, because it allowed many who suffered the degradation and sometimes physical abuse of racism and relative isolation to share with a vast number of people their pain as well as their hope and optimism for a better day. And I don't know whether any of your listeners were young people there. I've been fortuitously blessed by one, by the fortuitous accident of longevity. I'm 80 years of age. I spent some 8 years from 1960 to 1968, often 24/7, 365 days a year, working with Martin Luther King Jr. I have seen a lot and witnessed a lot since April 4th, 1968, when he was assassinated. And I give a course in a graduate school of continuing studies here at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And the course is called From Slavery to Obama. And during the teaching of that course, I tried to place Martin King into the pantheon of American history. And one of the things I say to hopefully help the students remember his place in history, I say the following. I say that in 12 years and 4 months, from 1956 to April 4th, 1968, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, Martin Luther King Jr. may have done more to achieve political, social, racial justice and equality in America than any other person or event in the previous 400 years of our history in our country. That's how I position him in the pantheon. Now, in terms of the speech, 100 years earlier, in November 1863, the other great speech in American history is the Gettysburg Address.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the time that Lincoln gave his address at Gettysburg after there were some more than 600,000 people killed and wounded in the Civil War. Well, 100 years after that, in August 1963, 100 years after Lincoln's Gettysburg in November 1863, Martin King gave this speech. And, the book, the important reason I wanted to write the book is that so many people who talk about the speech or reference the speech, most of them, I suspect that most of them think that this was just a great speech that Martin King gave, not knowing that that speech, which they quote, was entirely spontaneous, was entirely extemporaneous, was not part of the planned address that he had planned to give that day.
Mm-hmm.
It was totally spontaneous. The I was standing some, 25 feet, 50 feet maybe behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him as he was reading the text, prepared text, of which, I did contribute, as I had oftentimes with a fellow by the name of Stanley Levison, who's now deceased.
Mm-hmm.
I had summarized the thinking of a lot of people who had suggested what he might want to say that day, but I had put my summary in the form of actually suggested text that he might use. Little did I know, until I'm standing there listening to him speak, that the suggested textual paragraph that I had proposed that he consider opening his speech with and then segueing to whatever he wanted, he quoted verbatim the material which I had provided.
Was this about the checks? The
yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, about how we had come to claim heirs to the American people were all claim heirs to a promissory note, a check that has been returned unpaid, marked unpaid for insufficient funds. And we can't believe that there are insufficient funds in the vaults of justice of this country for this note to be repaid. And I went on. And then he added his own material. And it's when he was speaking, having quoted verbatim the material I had provided and his own additional written material,
mm-hmm.
that's when Mahalia Jackson, his famous gospel singer,
mm-hmm.
shouted to him and interrupted him and said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream."
And she was referring to another speech he'd given in Detroit.
I don't know that she was referring to that speech. What you're saying, I'll fast forward, is that, yes, in June he had used that phrase, "I have a dream." But I think she may have in fact been talking about the fact that he had said that in that speech, but she was talking about the fact that she had obviously heard him
mm-hmm.
heard to the concept of a dream in other speeches. So she said, tell him about the dream.
She was something of a muse to him.
Oh, yes. Very much so. But let me just finish. So
sure.
She shouts that to him, and I watch him take the text, the written prepared text, and I watch him move it to the side, to the left of his podium, standing. And he grabs the both ends, he looks out over the crowd. This is all in real time. And he then begins to speak spontaneously. And he segues into, from a written text, material he had written, into a spontaneous, extemporaneous text, which was unwritten. And so that which has become so celebrated and quoted was totally extemporaneous. And when I described it, I described it as was like capturing lightning in a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But really, as I talk to you and your listeners, is for someone I had seen, and other people too there, but particularly someone who had come to work with Martin King, I had seen and heard Dr. King give many speeches, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Some from the audience, some when I too was on the pulpit, or some when I was backstage, but I heard him speak, seen him speak many times. Never had I heard him or saw him speak like this before. It was as if on that day, at that place, at that time, that he had become something transcendental. He had come out of his body, as if there was this figure, this human form there, but there was this. As if this flesh and bones and this body standing there has suddenly become so transformed in something so powerful that I had never ever seen or heard. It was unbelievable. It's corny. You had to see it to believe it. You had to, and so when you hear it, you get a little goosebumps. But when you think about seeing it at the same time, and I am telling you that I had seen Martin King speak many, many times before, and I saw him speak many times after that. I have never, ever, ever, ever seen him transformed into that person, that being he became on that day. And I think it was a combination of the feedback between more than 250,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the vast view that he had. It was almost biblical. There was about four o'clock in the afternoon when he was speaking. The sun was being reflected off of the pool. Oh, you could see, as far as the eye can see, there were just people. There was the foot of the Lincoln Memorial, an acknowledgement that here he was in August, a few months after Birmingham, which would have been a very painful experience, in which some of your listeners may remember pictures on television of little black boys and girls having fire hoses. Slammed them against the wall, and police dogs snapping at them as they were peacefully demonstrating. And so, this was Medgar Evers had been assassinated in June. It had been an extremely traumatic, powerful life in this nation. 1963.
Yeah.
Of course, the president was assassinated in November of that year, November 22nd, and we were assembled in Washington, and Dr. King wanted to make a kind of prophetic validation. Dr. King's speech was an appeal to the conscience of America.
Let me ask you, Professor Jones, you decided to copyright the speech in advance. Had you ever done that with another speech before of his?
No.
At what spurred you, and you didn't know that it was going to be extemporaneously delivered. You didn't know it was going to be what it became.
No.
What inspired you to do that?
Well, first of all, the written prepared text that he was going to use
mm-hmm.
put as an insert into the press kit for the media, so that they would, you know, have an indication of what he was going to say.
Right.
If anyone goes in the history archives, you'll see that there's no mention of "I Have a Dream" reference in that speech at all. I had wanted to limit the distribution of the original prepared text because I wanted to be sure that he didn't lose his common law copyright. So I was concerned about copywriting, seeing that he had a copyright protection to the written text that he had prepared. And the moment, once he had delivered the speech, I immediately then filed for statutory copyright. But in order to be, your listeners have taken to a complicated area here, but in order to be eligible to file a piece of protection for statutory copyright, you still have to be sure that the owner of the copyrighted piece, or the piece to be copyrighted, has not lost their copyright ownership by prior publication. An indiscriminate large circulation would be deemed a publication to extinguish the owner's right to file for statutory copyright and to run the risk of having what was said being in so-called public domain.
Mm-hmm.
But because I had protected the speech, and so that when I, some week after, and I knew, by the way, that the March on Washington organization had signed an exclusive contract with Berry Gordy of Motown Records, that they would have the audio rights to reproduce and sell the record of the speech.
In advance, they had done that.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Okay. And so that, and so I copyrighted the speech. But and so a week after the march, I'm somewhere in New York City, and I'm passing a record store, and I'm listening to the speech on a loudspeaker coming to the record store, and I automatically assumed. I said to myself, boy, Barry Gordy's really fast. Motown really got that record out quickly, you know.
Mm.
And I went in to buy a copy of the record. It was only I picked it up. It wasn't Motown Records. It was something called 20th Century Fox Records. And I went back to my office and I called and I said, you don't have the right to. And they said, you don't have the right to sell and distribute this speech. Oh, yes, we do. It was in the public domain. And I had to go into federal court the next day to get an injunction against them using the speech. And I was granted an injunction. And the speech was enjoined from any further sale and by that company, and Motown, of course, went to continue to sell the authorized speech. Little did I know. I take no credit. It would be dishonest of me to say, well, I copyrighted it because one day I knew how valuable this is. That's not true. I copyrighted it just as a matter of defensive protection. I did copyright it a little bit out of annoyance because I was just sick and tired of so many instances I had observed of people taking advantage or trying to exploit the name, image, and likeness of Martin King. The common experience is that you'd be walking down the street and somebody would come out from a crowd and take a picture and get next to Martin King. And next thing you know, you go by a restaurant and there's a picture hanging in the window of the restaurant.
That's pretty. He was a celebrity. He was a superstar, and also trying to raise money a lot. So it became a great tool. Professor Jones, we have to take another break. When we return, we'll continue the conversation with Clarence Jones. He's the author, co-author of Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
A stroke transformed John Sarkin. He became an obsessive visual artist whose work was as fragmented and cluttered as his mind had become.
I've learned how to visually represent my existential dilemma caused by my stroke.
We'll talk with Sarkin and the author of a new book about him on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. WOSU and Slow Food Columbus present the Chefs in the City 2011 book signing with Chef Jacques Pepin at the North Market this Thursday at 4 p.m. Jacques will sign copies of his book, but you must obtain a virtual ticket to reserve a spot in line. Visit WOSU.org/chefs for virtual tickets and more information. Proceeds from this Chefs in the City event directly benefit children's educational programming on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
60 degrees in downtown Columbus. A chance of rain today, otherwise cloudy skies, a high of 67. A better chance of rain tonight, a low of 49 degrees. And showers and thunderstorms are likely on Tuesday, a high of 67. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Clarence B. Jones, author of the new book, Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Professor Jones served as an advisor to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and he was his personal lawyer, and he also was one of his speech writers. If you have a question or comment for Professor Jones, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, the idea that Reverend King could come up with something like this off the top of his head wasn't unprecedented, and you never heard him do it again. But it wasn't beyond the realm of possibility, particularly after I read that amazing letter, the amazing work, his letter from a Birmingham jail. He was able to pull things together. He had a wonderful memory.
Dr. King had a photographic memory. He was an erudite. The doctor referred to his having a Ph.D. in theology from the Boston School of Theology. He was learned and well-read in the classics, the Greek classics, mm-hmm. In literature, Shakespeare, in the political, in Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Voltaire, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Marx, Engels, Darwin, Aristotle, and of course, encyclopedic about the Bible as well as the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
He could quote Shakespeare as he could the Bible, as he could poetry. And so, yes, he was very learned. You know, the letter you referred to from the Birmingham jail was written during the 1963 events in Birmingham that I referred to earlier.
Right.
He was imprisoned, and I was the lawyer. I was his lawyer, so I was only the only person aside from his family, his wife, who was permitted to come in and visit him. So when I came in to see him shortly after he was in jail, I came in because I had needed some advice and from him, or need to consult with him about an urgent problem we had in Birmingham, was raising bail for those students, those young people who had followed him and gotten arrested and who were incarcerated. And we're getting into the second, almost going to the third night when they were incarcerated, and their parents were getting, they wanted to have their kids out of jail. And we didn't have all the resources to post the bail money. So I went into visit with Dr. King to tell him about that problem. When I went in to discuss the problem with him, it's not that he didn't care about the problem, but he was somewhat almost dismissive of the urgency which I gave to that, because he says, "Have you seen this?" And I said, "What is this?" And he was responding to a full-page ad that had appeared about him in the Birmingham Herald that week, signed by 8 to 10 white clergymen. And the ad had, in effect, was a polemic written attack on him, his coming to Birmingham, his beliefs, and in effect saying that things in Birmingham would be okay if Martin Luther King, this outsider, would just go home. And so when I came in, he was writing on every space he could find, on dirty newspaper, toilet paper, anything that was written. And then he gave me these pieces of paper to take out, to give to his secretary, Dora McDonald, and then pleaded with me to say that when I came back in to see him, which I was going to see him again that day, to bring him in blank sheets of paper. So what I did, I took out what he wrote under my shirt, and when I came back in, I brought in yellow sheets of paper. And I did this for a couple of days during my time of visiting him, and what I brought out became the famous letter from a Birmingham jail. By the way, I was so busy and preoccupied with the problem of raising bail money mm-hmm. that I never read what he wrote until almost a week later. And when I picked it up and I saw what this written response was, what had so agitated him so much, I said, oh, my God, this is amazing, because he had written this masterful political, social polemic in response to this ad. And in it, he was quoting. He quoted from different writers. He quoted from the Bible, we would expect him to be. But it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
When I would be drafting certain speeches for a different particular occasion, and you would see me working at home most of the time, you'd see me, and I'd be surrounded by about 15 books.
Right.
Okay.
Like the rest of us mere mortals, right?
Books, because I'd have to the things, okay? Because
mm-hmm.
I'd have to look if I wanted to check myself on what I was quoting or a concept I was developing. He didn't have anything. It was all written out of his head. It was brilliant. The letter from the Birmingham jail. So I said those of your listeners who are listening to our conversation, to remind that I am going to be out in the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. I just heard the weather report. I'm disappointed that apparently it's going to be raining tomorrow.
Well, that happens here. If folks want to get more information on that, there are a few tickets left. They can go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you and more information about that. Clarence Jones, our guest this hour, author of Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation, close advisor to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
And a great show. I was almost going to listen to some old Grateful Dead album, but instead I kept you on, and I'm so glad I did.
Thank you.
And Professor Jones, I thank you very much. You have illuminated a great deal of history. I can't listen to the speech without crying. Mm-hmm. I'm just a middle-aged white guy, you know. I am somewhat disturbed by the vexatious and seemingly venal squabbling that has gone on after the death of Dr. King amongst his family members. It's kind of hard to choose your descendants, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it seems that every so often, you know, there's somebody who wants an extra, you know, load of cash. And I don't mean to be vexatious. I'm just saying this seems to be a spoiling kind of effort on the parts of some folks. Is there anything you would say? I'll stay on the line.
Well, let me just say, first of all, sir, thank you for calling in. And by the way, I'm honored that you made a choice to listen to this. I have some adult sons, and one of my sons followed Jerry Garcia and Grateful Dead around for 1 year.
Oh, gee.
I actually had had the experience of meeting Jerry Garcia in Madison Square Garden. They went backstage.
Wow.
And Jerry Garcia, the bear hug of a guy, he said, "So you're Dana's father. Come over here and give me a hug." I had a son who, along with three or four other people, they spent a year wherever the Grateful Dead toured. That's where they went, including outside the country. But let me just respond to the more important part of your question. First of all, yes, it is sad. It is sad that there's squabbling. But let me just try to put this into context, all right? I have said America owes a great debt to Martin Luther King Jr. And sometimes when I hear people criticize, sometimes valid and sometimes not so valid, or characterize the King children, for example, or the estate as being greedy for money, my response is simply this. When the Treasury of the United States issues a check for about $1 billion to the estate of Martin Luther King Jr. for the contribution that he has made to this country, then I will entertain anybody's serious question about whether his children are being greedy. But until that happens, I think that I don't succumb or support their style. I don't think they share. This is Clarence Jones speaking. I'm not speaking for the King Institute. It's just Professor Clarence Jones,
mm-hmm.
who knew Dr. King, and who knew how hard he worked for this country and indeed for his children. And it's not generally known. And I like to remind the children who may be listening, and to those people don't know, is that there's an unnamed hero in the King family that took care of them, and that man's name was Harry Belafonte. Okay? And much of Dr. King's ability to function was because Harry Belafonte and his office financially supported them, the children, and Dr. King. Now, I am dismayed and I get disheartened when I hear that there's squabbling about money. But I guess having known the magnitude of the contribution that I've just said earlier in this program, when mm-hmm. I tried to characterize what I thought he had done for this country, it's hard to put a dollar amount. So I'm not being facetious. I'm just trying to say, well, just pick a number. And so I just pick a number. I said, okay, give the estate $1 billion. And then when they're asking for something, you can say, yes, you're now being greedy. But until then, there's no amount of money, none, nothing whatsoever, can ever compensate the children or the estate of Martin Luther King Jr. for their loss or the magnitude of his contribution.
Thanks to Paul and Worthington, Professor Jones, we have an email from a listener. They write, if this isn't too off topic, how does the professor react today to people who take Dr. King and say, Dr. King would have supported this or that? For example, the Glenn Beck rally last year or the protests over collective bargaining limitations this spring. When people suppose what Dr. King would think or say, what do you say to that?
What do I say to that? Mm-hmm. I try to make it plain and simple. That I try to go for the jugular vein and tell them that they have to stop pimping and prostituting the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. I, as long as I have a breath in this 80-year-old body, I will, like a ferocious lion or lioness, I guess, protecting a cub or attack police dog, I am sick and tired of having both black and white, both having civil rights people and other people pimping what I call the legacy and mantle of Martin Luther King Jr. for their own political purposes. And so whenever it occurs, I speak out about it. So with respect to Mr. Beck, is that I watched the Glenn Beck rally. And before I had watched it, I had a totally negative reaction to it. And then after I watched it, I had a much more balanced reaction. And so by the balanced reaction to Glenn Beck's rally, for those of you who may not know what's being talked about here, Glenn Beck held a rally on August 28, 2010, at the same place at the same time that the March on Washington occurred. And during the course of that rally, there were many references to the I Have a Dream speech. The rally in and of itself was an acknowledgement of the power of the continuing legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And all fairness to Mr. Beck is that while he did use the occasion to push his own agenda, is that he did, during the course of 3 or 4 hours, whatever it was, he did give due acknowledgement to the contribution of what Martin King said and did on that day. And so I have a much more measured response to what he did on that day, and I try to separate my response to that day from what he has said on other occasions. But with respect to the rally, I think the rally is both a combination as an acknowledgement of Beck's understanding and his followers of the power of Martin King's continuing power. And then, of course, it is their effort to use for their own purposes the power of that legacy. That's what I object to. So I applaud and acknowledge that the fact that he headed at that place at that time, but I object to is using it for his own political purposes.
Professor Jones, why did we only have a few more minutes left, really just about a minute, but I was wondering, why did you wait until you were, why didn't you write this 20 years ago or even 10 years ago? Why now?
I had mixed emotions. First of all, I was somewhat tempered after the assassination of Dr. King, as I had a very strong disagreement between myself and the family. I respected they had a different attitude about James Earl Ray than I did.
Mm-hmm.
I had some differences about the estate and the conduct of the estate and some of what I thought the conduct of the people associated with it. And then it was the cumulative thing of seeing so much happening in 2008, seeing so many constant references to Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said, you know, I have a responsibility. If I don't make this record, nobody's going to really know. You know? And so that's the reason.
Professor Jones, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Professor Clarence B. Jones, he will be in Columbus in New Albany on Wednesday. You can learn more about that visit at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.